This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
Right now, a geopolitical trade war is accidentally creating the exact technological leaps it was designed to prevent.
It is a massive backfire, honestly.
It really is. Welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. If you are tuning in, you are likely trying to navigate a tech landscape that feels like it's just, well, it's rewriting its own rules daily at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Every single day.
And our mission today is to cut through all that noise. We are going to extract the vital insights from a briefing report provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim. And just to be upfront, we are just reporting on the analysis in his brief, not taking any political sides on global trade policies.
Right. We are just looking at the mechanics of what is actually happening on the ground.
Exactly. We are looking at a system under immense pressure. We're talking international trade restrictions, super volatile financial markets, and this unrelenting corporate demand for efficiency.
And we are tracking how the AI industry is being forced to evolve in some wildly unpredictable ways because of all that pressure.
Which brings us to the theme of today's deep dive, action and reaction. Let's start with the hardware side, because we are seeing a really profound reaction to global semiconductor sanctions right now.
A huge reaction. I mean, look at what happened on July 10th.
Right. The Chinese company Zhongke Sugan officially launched the Sugan 8000.
And this is not a small deployment. This is a 100,000 card AI supercluster.
100,000. And the defining characteristic you really need to understand here is that this system is built from 100% Chinese domestic components.
Every single piece of it.
Yeah, the Higon chips, the computing architecture, the storage arrays, the networking topology, even the liquid cooling systems are entirely domestic.
Which is, I mean, what's fascinating here is just the sheer engineering magnitude of that achievement.
Because it's not just about snapping a bunch of fast chips together, right?
No, not at all. When you try to string together 100,000 AI accelerator cards, the individual processor speed actually becomes sort of secondary.
Secondary to what?
To the interconnect bandwidth. The primary challenge is just preventing a massive data traffic jam.
Oh, right. Because they all have to talk to each other.
Exactly. If those 100,000 nodes can't communicate instantaneously, the processors just sit there idle, waiting for data. And then your multi-billion dollar supercomputer becomes highly inefficient.
Right. So developing a domestic networking solution capable of handling that throughput, doing it entirely in-house, is just a staggering technical hurdle to clear.
It really is.
Not to mention the thermodynamics. I mean, running 100,000 processors at peak load generates enough heat to literally melt the silicon if it isn't managed perfectly.
Yeah, you need serious liquid cooling for that.
And to engineer a domestic cooling stack end-to-end for a cluster of this size, well, it proves this isn't just some prototype. It is a highly stabilized, production-ready system.
And we see that stability reflected in its actual deployment. The report notes it is already integrated into China's national supercomputing internet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's actively optimizing over 300 different applications. Plus, a second 100,000 card system is already under agreement with the Beijing Academy of Artificial Intelligence.
So they are scaling this architecture rapidly. And the technical specs reflect a really intentional design philosophy, too.
Right. The report highlights the system's versatility. It manages everything from FP64 down to INT8 on a single unified cluster.
Which is wild because usually you see hardware optimized for one extreme or the other, right? Not both at the same time.
Yeah, but that dual capability is their strategic advantage. Like FP64, that's double precision floating point format, is mandatory for high stakes scientific computing.
Like aerospace or pharma.
Exactly. If you are simulating fluid dynamics for an airplane wing, or calculating molecular structures for a new drug, you cannot afford rounding errors. You need the immense accuracy of FP64.
But then INT8 is totally different.
Right. INT8 is an 8-bit integer format. It is much lower precision, which drastically reduces the memory footprint and speeds up processing.
And that is exactly what you want for AI inference, right? Like deploying a trained large language model to generate responses quickly for millions of users.
Spot on. So by running both on the Sugan 8000, they've built an infrastructure capable of serving cutting-edge scientific research and commercial AI software simultaneously.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly grasp the geopolitical weight of this, we need a better framework than just geeking out over a spec sheet.
Fair enough.
Think about these semiconductor sanctions like an embargo on refined steel. If a dominant country suddenly cuts off the global supply of construction steel to a rapidly growing city, that city doesn't just, you know, abandon its plans for skyscrapers.
Right, they still need to build.
Exactly. Instead, they are forced to completely rethink their infrastructure. They start mining their own iron. They build their own smelting plants. They invent new architectural techniques to work with whatever materials they have.
Which takes a massive amount of time and money up front.
An agonizing amount. But eventually, they construct a skyscraper. And the defining shift is that they now own the entire vertical supply chain. They no longer rely on your gym or, well, your steel market in this case.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that analogy mirrors the specific analysis provided by former lawmaker Kyungjin Kim in today's report.
How so?
Well, the U.S. export controls on advanced semiconductors were instituted with a really clear objective to cap China's AI capabilities by restricting access to the most advanced global hardware.
Right, tie their hands, basically.
But former lawmaker Kyungjin Kim identifies the inherent paradox of these sanctions. By entirely removing the option to just buy off-the-shelf Western technology, the sanctions force the immediate capitalization and development of a self-sufficient domestic ecosystem.
So the Sugon 8000 is basically empirical evidence of that reaction.
Exactly. Rather than crippling the industry, the restrictions acted as a forcing function for supply chain independence.
It is fascinating to see how state-backed hardware initiatives are finding that kind of stability and independence. But man, when we look across the aisle at the software side of the AI boom, it is a completely different story.
Oh, it is absolute chaos.
Total chaos. The private markets for AI startups are just incredibly volatile right now.
The contrast is really stark. Because while hardware requires predictable, massive long-term capital, software startups are trapped in this hyper-volatile cycle of hype crashing into financial reality.
And the situation with the Chinese large model company Minimax perfectly illustrates this turbulence, doesn't it?
It really does. The numbers in the report for Minimax are just staggering.
Yeah, they just closed a funding round raising 16.04 billion Hong Kong dollars.
Which converts to roughly 2.8 trillion Korean won.
Right. They utilized a mix of new shares and convertible bonds, and the investor demand was ravenous. The subscription was oversubscribed 7 times over.
7 times. The market was essentially just fighting for equity to fund their AI infrastructure and the global rollout of their harness products.
But, and here's the crazy part, on paper, a 7x oversubscribed round looks like a massive win, right? But the timing makes this a quintessential study in market dynamics.
Because this massive influx of institutional and venture capital collided directly with a severe retail stock plunge.
On the exact same day.
Literally the same day, yeah. And it was triggered by a lockup expiration.
So for the uninitiated, a lockup expiration is that designated date after an IPO when early insiders, founders, and pre-IPO investors are finally legally permitted to sell their shares on the open market.
Right. They can finally cash out.
And when you suddenly introduce a flood of available shares into the market, the supply outstrips demand and the stock price inevitably craters.
So you have Minimax pulling in billions in fresh funding on the exact same day their public valuation is taking a total nosedive.
Talk about whiplash. In the middle of all this, founder Yan Junji released an internal letter. He pledged to take zero salary until the company achieves AGI.
And he committed to distributing 5% of his personal shares to the employees.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. I look at a move like that, and I have to challenge the motive here.
You think it's just PR?
I mean, if I am an investor watching a massive stock plunge wipe out retail value, a founder suddenly declaring they will work for free until they build a superintelligence feels incredibly performative.
I can see why you'd think that.
Right. Is this genuine devotion to the technological mission, or is it a calculated PR tactic engineered to redirect the media narrative away from the bleeding stock price?
I definitely see why you would lean towards cynicism there. But I wouldn't write it off as just a distraction.
No.
No, you have to consider the internal mechanics of building AGI. The compute costs are astronomical, obviously, but the talent retention costs are equally brutal.
That's fair. AI researchers aren't cheap.
Exactly. And when a stock plunges after a lockup expiration, the engineers who hold equity see their net worth vanish overnight.
Oh, I see. So they might just jump ship.
Right. So giving up 5% of his personal shares is a necessary triage maneuver to stop a massive talent exodus.
And the zero salary pledge.
It's a signaling mechanism. He is trying to force the market and his own engineers to look past the quarterly stock fluctuations and focus on the decade-long time horizon required for AGI.
Okay, you are right that retaining high-level AI talent requires aggressive equity compensation. but it still highlights the sheer whiplash of the sector.
It does. And lawyer Kunjin Kim's commentary in the report captures this perfectly.
What's his take?
He notes that this specific scenario, the 7x oversubscribed funding, clashing with the lockup plunge, and the founder's dramatic pledge, it encapsulates the dual emotions driving AI valuation right now.
Dual emotions. I like that phrasing.
Yeah, you have this extreme euphoric optimism about the transformative potential of AGI pulling in billions, constantly battling the cold, unforgiving mechanical realities of public market structures.
That volatility seems largely confined to the software and large language model space, though, because when you look at companies applying AI to physical mechanics, the financial narrative cleans up a lot.
Oh, totally. The report highlights Roke, for example.
Right, they're a robotics company whose automated systems are utilized in Xiaomi's YU7 car welding lines.
And they just executed an IPO in Hong Kong. But instead of the turbulence we saw with Minimax, Roke's stock popped 15.21% on the first day of trading.
Why do you think that is? Just easier to understand?
Basically, yeah. The investment thesis for physical AI is simply much easier for the market to underwrite. Large language models are currently burning billions on compute. They struggle with hallucination issues, and they're still trying to prove their long-term enterprise moats.
But a welding robot?
A welding robot executes high-precision chassis welding. The value proposition is immediate, tangible, and easily quantifiable in terms of factory throughput and error reduction. The market rewards that predictability.
Make a car faster, save money. Simple. And, you know, we are about to see the boundaries between hardware devices and software agents blur even further.
We really are.
The report includes a brief tease that ZTE and Nubia are scheduled to unveil the world's first AI agent phone at the World AI Conference in Shanghai on July 17th.
Which means hardware manufacturers aren't just hosting apps anymore. They are architecting devices around native AI agents.
Which signals a fundamental shift in user interaction, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We are moving away from AI as a discrete cloud service you visit in a browser toward AI as a persistent embedded layer operating within your personal hardware.
And that transition provides a perfect bridge to the final major development in today's briefing.
Exactly.
We've spent this time examining the macro level forces, right? The geopolitics shaping superclusters and the market psychology swinging billions in capital. But now we need to look at how these advancements are landing directly on your desktop.
And more importantly, the specific hidden risks embedded in that convenience.
Let's get into it. So on July 10th, OpenAI initiated a sweeping rollout, making ChatGPT work available across all desktop plans and expanding it through their web and mobile paid tiers.
And this infrastructure is powered by their newly deployed GPT 5.6, encompassing the Sol, Terra, and Luna series models.
Plus, they launched a public beta for Sites, which is a tool enabling the AI to deploy and manage web properties directly.
But the critical evolution here is the upgrade to ChatGPT work.
Right, because it is no longer functioning merely as a chatbot. It is operating as a fully integrated agent.
Which is a huge distinction.
Massive. It has the API hooks to embed itself directly into your digital workflow. It connects to your Slack channels, Microsoft Teams, Google Drive, SharePoint, your Outlook email, and your calendar.
And if you use the desktop client, it even has permissions to scan your local hard drive and utilize an internal browser.
We really need to define the technical distinction between a chatbot and an agent because it changes the risk profile entirely.
I completely agree. A chatbot relies on retrieval augmented generation, or AIR. You prompt it, it retrieves relevant text, and it generates an answer. It is fundamentally reactive.
But an agent?
An agent is autonomous. You assign it a high-level goal, and it independently navigates your software ecosystem, identifies the necessary resources, extracts the data, executes a sequence of logical tasks, and produces a finalized output.
Okay, so what does this all mean for your actual workday? Let me give you a concrete example of the utility here.
Go for it.
Imagine you are staring at a Google Drive folder containing three massive 80-page PDF contracts. Previously, a human would have to download them, read through all that dense legalese just to find the liability clauses, copy the text, and manually format a comparative spreadsheet.
Which takes hours.
Hours. Now, with ChatGPT work, you input one sentence. Extract the damage clauses from these three contracts and generate a comparison table.
And the mechanism behind that execution is incredible. The agent leverages its API connection to Google Drive, navigates to those specific PDFs, utilizes semantic understanding to identify the legal parameters of a damage clause amidst all that surrounding text, extracts the relevant data points, formats them into a structured table, and delivers the final asset.
It compresses hours of cognitive labor into seconds of processing time.
It is the ultimate productivity hack.
It really is. But I look at the level of access required to execute that, and I see a systemic vulnerability just waiting to be exploited.
This raises an important question, and it is the exact warning former lawmaker Kunjin Kim emphasizes in his analysis.
Which is what?
You cannot achieve that level of automated convenience without granting the agent sweeping, foundational access to your digital ecosystem.
Because it needs to read everything to know what's there.
Precisely. For the AI to extract those damage clauses, it must have the perpetual authorization to read every single document in that drive. It must be able to scan your emails to cross-reference dates and access your local files to verify context.
Which means if you are running a corporate law firm, a financial consultancy, or a healthcare practice, you are injecting a highly capable autonomous system directly into a repository of confidential client data.
Yeah. The blast radius of a compromised agent is catastrophic.
Catastrophic.
Well, in traditional software, if an employee's word processor crashes, you lose a document.
Mm-hmm.
But if an integrated AI agent is manipulated, say, through an external prompt injection attack, or even just an employee inadvertently asking it to summarize a restricted file and outputting it to an unsecured platform, it can expose the entire historical data structure of the firm.
Oh, wow. And it isn't just malicious attacks either. The friction comes from the AI trying to be, you know, too helpful.
Exactly.
Like if an unauthorized user asks the agent a question about company revenue, and the agent decides the best way to answer is by scanning the CFO's private SharePoint folder because it happens to have the credentials to do so.
Then you have an internal data breach executed by your own productivity tool.
Which is terrifying.
It is. And it's why lawyer Kunjin Kim stresses that organizations cannot simply deploy these tools and allow them default access. The integration requires aggressive architectural boundaries.
So what do companies actually need to do?
You must implement strict access controls, compartmentalize data silos so the agent only sees what is absolutely necessary, and maintain immutable logs of every single file the AI touches.
So you can audit it later?
Right. His core takeaway is uncompromising.
Uh-huh.
If you prioritize seamless convenience first and treat security as an afterthought, the ultimate casualty is trust.
Man. Prioritize convenience first, and the ultimate casualty is trust. That is a sobering reality check.
It really is. If an agent leaks proprietary client data, the efficiency gains will not save your reputation.
It forces us to stop treating software as just a passive tool, like a calculator, and start managing it as an active participant in the workflow.
One that requires oversight, restricted clearances, and constant auditing.
It demands a completely new framework for enterprise security, really.
Yeah, the tools have evolved from execution to autonomy, and our governance models have to evolve just as quickly.
Which perfectly encapsulates the journey we've taken through today's report. We started by examining how the brute force of international sanctions drove an opposite, equal reaction.
Right, the creation of a massive, fully independent Chinese hardware ecosystem
right.
capable of running complex scientific and AI models on the same unified architecture.
Then we navigated the financial whiplash of the software sector, where the euphoria of funding AGI crashes into the mechanical reality of lockup expirations,
forcing founders to leverage their own equity just to keep the mission alive.
And finally, we brought it all the way down to the micro level, looking at how the drive for frictionless productivity is embedding autonomous AI agents deeply into our personal workflows, requiring us to fundamentally rethink how we protect our most sensitive data.
You really start to see the systemic pressures driving the headlines.
Yeah.
You aren't just looking at isolated product launches anymore. You are watching the mechanics of a global shift in real time.
And as we close out today's analysis, I want to leave you with a scenario to consider that ties these macro and micro forces together.
I love this one.
Yeah. We spent the first half of this deep dive exploring how geopolitical friction is forcing the development of completely isolated parallel hardware architectures like the Sugon 8000.
Right, walled gardens.
And we spent the second half discussing how deeply integrated autonomous AI agents are about to run our enterprise workflows.
So fast forward 5 years.
Exactly. What happens when an advanced Western AI agent, heavily integrated into a U.S. logistics company, attempts to autonomously negotiate a complex supply chain contract with an Eastern AI agent operating on a completely independent, parallel infrastructure?
Will they even be operating on compatible digital frameworks?
Or, by building these walled-off hardware and software ecosystems today, are we actively engineering a future where Global AI agents fundamentally cannot communicate with one another.
That is a brilliant and incredibly complex problem to leave us with. The technology is advancing, but the infrastructure is fracturing.
It is definitely something to mull over. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning the underlying mechanics of the technology you use every day. Keep an eye on those market forces, and we will catch you next time.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.